It is Thursday, June 6th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, some new data surrounding teen moms in Arkansas.
Statewide, we have, for 15-year-olds that have delivered a baby, 10% of them are pregnant again within 12 months. That number heralds a real challenge for that mom and for the family that is supporting them and the community within which they reside.
Plus, a local relief fund is designed to help with immediate needs for people affected by last week's tornadoes in Benton County, while other funds take longer to get processed.
We want to be able to get money out and help people quickly is a big part of this.
And trying to ease the pain of the loss of federal help to pay for internet bills for low-income households.
People actually across the country, and including here in Arkansas, who will no longer be receiving that $30 a month and $10 a month, depending on how they're receiving the benefit subsidy.
First, the news from NPR.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville invites guests to explore nature's wonders at their exhibition, Exquisite Creatures, open now and on display until July 29th. This exhibit showcases the colorful animals, plants, and minerals found in nature. Tickets and information at crystalbridges.org.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, June 6th, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Later on our show, helping with the immediate needs for those impacted by the May 26th tornadoes. We hear from the Benton County Relief Fund in our second half hour today. First, though, while the number of teenage mothers in the U.S. is on the decline, Arkansas still ranks the second highest in the country for teen birth rates, according to numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And a recent study from the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement looks at alarming trends in teenage pregnancy across the state. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth spoke with ACHI President Dr. Joe Thompson about the new research.
Nice. So, Dr. Thompson, can you just sort of, you know, tell me a little bit about this report that ACHI put out on teen pregnancy rates in Arkansas? You know, what were the major takeaways that you found?
This is one more in a series of reports looking at maternal health issues in Arkansas. This focused on teen births and also the spacing between when a teen has their first birth and then potentially a subsequent birth. Arkansas has one of the highest teenage birth rates in the nation. Our state birth rate is about 26 births per 1,000 teens, or about 2% of teens being pregnant in a year, and that compares to 14 per 1,000, or 1.4, so almost twice the teenage birth rate. So this was an important study that we looked at not only when teenagers had their first child, but also how many teenagers had a subsequent child as a teen, you know, that leads then to even more challenges for that young mother.
Talking about the challenges, could you just sort of break down, you know, either health challenges or social challenges that you know, young women face if they do get pregnant at a young age, and maybe how that impacts them if they then go on to, you know, have another kid after that as well?
Well, teens having babies, particularly those that are less than 18 and should be still in high school, face many challenges. I think there are health challenges with children, really. We have kids as young as 12 years old, unfortunately, having babies in our state. So children, young teens having babies with the health challenges that come there. Obviously, having a baby places increased not only physical but psychological stress on the mom. Also makes it harder to do the things that young teens need to be doing, going to school, thinking about their future workforce engagement, building their social networks.
Yeah, and I know a lot of this study was also focusing on that birth spacing. So could you break down sort of what that is and what you guys found looking at that?
Nationally, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists recommends birth spacing between deliveries to be at least 18 months. That gives the mom a chance to recover from the first pregnancy. It lets her bond with that first child. And it lets the first child gain some autonomy before a second child is introduced into the family. So we looked at birth spacing. That's 18 months for healthy adult women. Unfortunately, we see in the birth certificate data from Arkansas, we see teens as early as 14 or 15 having yet another pregnancy within 12 months. So these are teenagers not only that have been impacted by a first pregnancy, but they then subsequently have a second delivery even while they're still in their school-aged years.
And I know that this study looked at, it was 2019, 2021, right?
Correct.
And so, I know that that rate has gone down a little bit over the past like decade or so, but we're still fairly high, like you were saying, in Arkansas compared to nationally. So what is the issue here? You know, why is this such a problem for us here in Arkansas?
You know, I think our challenges here in Arkansas are several fold. We need our parents to feel equipped and comfortable in talking about reproductive health with their children, probably at an earlier age than parents think they should. So 11, 12, 13-year-olds need to have already had that conversation. That's boys and girls. When we fail in that, we need to have other sources of information, whether that's your church or a social organization or school-based reproductive health education. I think all of these are important, critical steps into helping our youth understand how their bodies work and what their bodies have the potential for. I think as we see, you know, teens having early births, there are opportunities to prevent the second birth for having, you know, the introduction of long-acting reversible contraceptives. These are well-established mechanisms to prevent unintended pregnancies or frequent repeat pregnancies. So those opportunities for clinical intervention are present. And then I think the support that our communities can offer to help make sure that the conversation around the topic is not one that is in secrecy or that has any overlay of inappropriateness, but that, you know, people are comfortable having conversations about what the impact is of early deliveries and what the opportunities are to prevent those.
And from the, I guess, statewide level with policymakers or even, you know, nonprofits or other interest groups who are working to maybe combat this issue, what have you seen from them and what would you like to see? How would you like it to go further maybe?
I think importantly, we are having a discussion now around maternal health and factors that influence that. You know, I think frequently, you know, we look at the outcome of maternal mortality, that is the death of a mother, but there's a lot of maternal morbidity impact on mothers, both health effects and otherwise, that are important to document. And probably it's a special set of issues for our teen mothers because of where they are in their life stage. So this is one more analytic contribution that our centers tried to provide into the dialogue and discussion. The birth spacing issue is true for all mothers, but it's particularly true for our young teens who have that first baby to make sure that we don't have a second baby and increase the odds of her, you know, failing to achieve what she could through her life stage development.
Yeah, and I was wondering when you were doing this study and when it's, you know, showing sort of there was a breakdown with different regions of the state statistic-wise, were there any specific areas where it was more prevalent or was anyone more at risk for this? I don't know how those numbers, if there was a demographic breakdown or geographic at all.
There are some slight geographic differences with Northwest Arkansas being at, you know, 23.6 births to teens for every 1,000 compared with 26. That's not a big variation. And so I think Northwest Arkansas has an equal challenge to that of the rest of the state.
There's a lot of issues around maternal health that you guys could look at. Why was it important to focus on teen pregnancy and this issue?
This is one of the steps, you know, along our birthing journey that we're advocating for improved support of moms across the state. Teens are a very special group, particularly our early age teens. And, you know, the intentionality of getting pregnant and having a child is an important first step of control for young mothers as they bring, you know, newborns into the Arkansas space. One of the statistics that really jumps out and is of concern to me is the birth spacing of particularly our younger teens. Statewide, we have for 15-year-olds that have delivered a baby, 10% of them are pregnant again within 12 months. That number heralds a real challenge for that mom and for the family that is supporting them and the community within which they reside.
And so if someone is reading this, maybe it's a parent or a teacher or someone who has an impact on a teen's life, what do you hope they take away from a study like this or from learning this information?
I hope they take away the fact that this is a real issue in our state, that we have some of the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the United States, and the need to have an open, honest, candid conversation with our youth about reproductive health. Hopefully the source is the family, but if not the family, we've got to have secondary sources of information so that our teens have the information they need to lead a healthy and intentional life.
That was Dr. Joe Thompson with the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth earlier this week. Ahead today, agencies like FEMA and the Red Cross can financially help people recovering from last week's tornadoes over time, but not necessarily immediately. The Benton County Relief Fund is designed to help now.
We want to be able to get money out and help people quickly is a big part of this.
More about the creation of a fund to help people affected by the May 26th storms ahead this hour. A Pulaski County circuit judge has blocked the emergency clause of the rule that would restrict gender-neutral Arkansas driver's licenses and IDs. The ruling on Wednesday came down just days before a public hearing is scheduled with the Department of Finance and Administration. The X option has been available for Arkansans to use with no documentation required since December of 2010. Scott Harden, spokesperson for the department, says the promulgation of the permanent rule was not affected by the court ruling, only the emergency clause element. That public hearing will still move forward as scheduled. This Saturday, the city of Fayetteville is hosting the 7th annual Ladies Do Fayetteville Duathlon at Lake Fayetteville. The multi-sport race will include a 2-mile run, followed by an 11-mile bike ride, and then another 2-mile run. Athletes can take the challenge solo or add two other relayers to break up the race. Tiffany Hoover, the assistant recreation superintendent for the city, says the duathlon is a great way to venture into a new sport, especially if you lack experience, as you'll be part of a friendly and encouraging community.
It's definitely a great race for beginners. We have a lot of people who participate that they're a runner. They do running. That's their thing. They'll try to ride a bike sometimes, but they've never like thought about racing on a bike. And so we get a lot of first time to multi-sport racing participants. And on the other end, you know, a lot of people that like they bike all the time, they're not really sure how they feel about running, but they think they could manage running 2 miles twice. And so a lot of it are people who are already pretty active in whatever discipline they do more of. But putting them together in a race format may be a first time for them. But we also, too, have, kind of seasoned triathletes and multi-sport racers that come out and participate as well. So it's a fun mix.
Hoover says the diversity of competitors is not limited to their experience level.
Another thing that's neat to see is there's very much a variety of bicycle types at the race. We've had everything from a triathlon style bike to road bike, hybrid bike. We've even had people on like a beach cruiser type bike and even more of like a mountain bike. So you see a variety in just what type of bicycle is being ridden with the event. And then as most racing events and things, you just see a wide variety of ages and like body shapes and sizes. And that's just another thing that makes it really cool.
The competition is only open to female, non-binary, or gender non-conforming participants. Hoover says that the city created the race to provide more options to people who might not feel welcome at other competitive events.
So when we created the race series back in 2015, we kind of took a look at what wasn't being offered in Northwest Arkansas, because at that time we wanted to add more running and biking opportunities, but there already was a lot going on, especially in the running world at that time. And there was only really one or two other duathlon races in the area that were very much male heavy, kind of male dominated as far as registration numbers. So we thought, you know, it could be an opportunity. Maybe there's females out there who want to participate in a multi-sport race for the first time, but they may be a little intimidated by the typical participant field at some of the ones that were out there. So we thought, why not do one that's just for women and make it, you know, more accessible, welcoming, less intimidating environment, so they can come out and either keep doing what they've been doing or try something new.
Online registration for Ladies Do Fayetteville is open until noon tomorrow, Friday, June 7th. You can also sign up during in-person packet pickup Friday evening. Volunteers are also needed for the event. You can visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com, for more information about the duathlon, how to register, and volunteering opportunities. This is Ozarks at Large.
Time now for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On today's show, University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj will go over some of the latest numbers on the state and national economies. We also have details of some personnel moves by Arvest Bank and a rundown of what you will find in the new issue that is out this week of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. That's all ahead after the break on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Live fearless. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
On a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock, University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj offered his analysis on some of the latest data points about the state and national economies, including GDP numbers, jobless claims, and home sales. Taken together, what do they say about the economy? Here's Mervin Jebaraj with his interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you take the three headlines together, it might seem like we're finally getting that soft landing that was much talked about. But if you start digging into some of these numbers, you realize that this economy isn't landing anytime soon. So I think first, it's always important to come up with a definition of what a soft landing is. So I think, you know, we decided that 2% growth rate or 1.8% growth rate before the pandemic, we decided that that would be the neutral growth rate of the U.S. economy. So soft landing has to be less than that without a recession. Anything above 1.8 can't be soft landing by definition, because that is doing better than what we assumed would be the, you know, normal growth rate before the pandemic. So if you look at the headline GDP number, I think they revised it down to 1.3%. So it sounds like definitely soft landing. But if you start digging through what's in the report, the reason the headline GDP is at 1.3% is because we've imported more than we exported in this first quarter of this year. So if you account for that distortion and look at simply the domestic economy, so that's you and I going and spending money in the U.S. economy, the businesses spending money in the U.S. economy, U.S.-based businesses spending money in the U.S. in the economy, and you can you know, add in residential construction, which picked up this year, you put those three things together, you would call that domestic private consumer. So the businesses, you and I, and residential investment, that is up to close to 3%. So it's very hard to say that, you know, the economy is slowing down when you and I and businesses and residential investment is basically adding about 3% to the U.S. economy in the first quarter. The reason why, you know, the headline number was lower is because if we're going out and spending money, especially on goods, those things are imported from other countries. And that's a subtraction from the GDP, you know, just for accounting purposes, because those things aren't made here. But overall, you and I are still going out and spending money. Businesses are still spending money, and residential investment is, residential construction is up. So put those three things together, it's hard to say that the economy, at least from the GDP perspective, is really at a soft landing in the first quarter. Take the new initial claims data, show that it was up slightly. Again, you have to keep in mind that the size of the labor force in the United States is significantly larger after the pandemic than before the pandemic. For two reasons. One is that a lot more people are participating in the labor force than in any time in the previous 20 or so years. So the percentage of folks between 25 years old and 55 years old, too old to be in college, too young to be retiring, is at a higher percent now than it has been in a couple of decades. So the overall level of participation is higher. We've had above normal immigration levels. So those people are participating in the labor force at higher levels as well. So put those two things together, you normalize that to the initial claims data. It doesn't really look that bad. Keep in mind that the unemployment rate has been under 4% for 27 months now. The last time that happened was 1969. So this, you know, the employment picture certainly not showing any signs of soft landing either. The one area of concern here that you mentioned was home sales were down. Pending home sales, the statistic that the National Association of Realtors recently released indicated it was at a significantly low level, compared it to a level before the financial crisis, the housing bust before. I think that's finally seeing some effect of the really high mortgage rates. So we started seeing mortgage rates decline a little late last year, earlier this year, but now mortgage rates are well above 7% again. I think that has certainly cooled home buying. I don't think that's necessarily going to improve anytime soon. We don't expect the mortgage rates to dramatically lower anytime soon this year. So I think overall levels of home buying still going to be fairly depressed. Hopefully all the inventory, you know, I mentioned residential construction's up, helps depress home prices and rents, and that generates some impetus in home buying. But right now, the mortgage rates are really what's driving it.
Let's look at this through a political lens, because you've got those headlines that you talked about that suggest the economy is cooling off, it is slowing down. That would, on one hand, be what the Federal Reserve would want to see happen. You're telling me that the data suggests it's not cooling off. But if I'm a Republican and I want to tell people that the economy is not doing as well under President Joe Biden, I get to point to those headlines. 1.3% GDP, jobless claims are up, home sales are slowing down. It's a pretty hard argument for the president to say, no, you got to crawl in those numbers and look at some of this other data that's right out here. Which political party is in better shape to spread their message to voters?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, some of this has to do with how well political parties can communicate the information. So there's plenty in there to complain about from both sides' perspectives. But I think, you know, the underlying economy seems to be doing fine in terms of, you know, overall growth. Wage growth in particular has done really well for U.S. workers, particularly for low-income workers, have seen significant, you know, we've seen the strongest wage growth for low-income workers in the United States. I think the real challenge for the Democratic side is to try to convey these arguments that, you know, the economy is doing well, the unemployment rate is stayed low for as long as it has, wage growth has been running faster than the pace of inflation. The, you know, thing that the Republicans really hang their hat on would be that the overall level of inflation under the Biden administration has been the highest it's been probably since, you know, Jimmy Carter was president. So the rate of inflation is what's coming down right now. But, you know, the level change that we've seen in prices of goods and services from 2019 to 2024, that pace of increase is significantly larger.
That is University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj on a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock. You can watch that full interview online over at our sister website, talkbusiness.net. In other news this week, Arvest Bank has promoted two Benton County executives to new leadership roles. Amy Morbeck is now Chief Product and Innovation Officer. Brad Crane is a regional executive for enhanced banking services. Those new jobs are effective starting next week. Terry Martin will resign as University of Arkansas Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs on June 30, 2025. A U of A administrator and faculty member for 40 years, Martin said he plans to return to a full-time faculty position in Fayetteville as a professor of electrical engineering. And the latest Northwest Arkansas Business Journal is out this week. For our cover story, Jeff De La Rosa has more details about Macaulay Place. That is a unique multifamily development under construction in Bentonville to address affordable housing challenges. Jim Petty is the CEO of Strategic Realty and the owner of Grassroots Construction. That's the developer and builder for the project. We've also got our annual list of the region's largest general contractors. Arvest Bank executive Chris Thornton writes about the collaborative approach needed for commercial construction projects. And although he is just 29 years old, construction company owner Trent Hanna already knows a vital business rule. Efficiency is the key to running a smooth operation. All that and much more is in the latest issue, and you can read the digital version for free at nwabusinessjournal.com. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Residents of Benton County recovering from the May 26 tornadoes and storms can receive help from the Benton County Relief Fund. The fund has been created through partnerships of private, public, and philanthropic entities. It will be administered by Accelerate Foundation in a similar manner to the relief the foundation directed through a partnership with Benton County during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Jeff Webster is president and CEO of Accelerate Foundation, and he joins me. Jeff, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
First of all, how does the Benton County Relief Fund work?
Well, it's meant to be relatively straightforward and fast response. So basically, there's a few different ways people can reach out to the county, their cities. There's links provided in all of those. I believe you have a link as well, or to the Accelerate Foundation website. And there is a link that explains the program, a little bit about it, the partners involved, the purpose of it, et cetera. And if they click that, then it takes them down a pathway of how they can get help, which will amount to someone talking with one of the people at our HARC organization, which is inside our foundation, that then walks them through the process.
And it should be pointed out, HARC is local. You'll be talking to someone that is here in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah, absolutely. So HARC is simply a division of Accelerate. And when you talked about helping with all of the Benton County and the relief fund, the actual distribution, qualification, all those things, we implement through our HARC organization, all people on the ground here that live in Northwest Arkansas.
How did the relief fund come together?
Well, it's been a great partnership as far as multiple entities coming together. I would start with crediting Judge Mooring first of all, reaching out to a lot of people, including us, and then convening a group of us made up of mayors of various cities that are involved, big cities, smaller cities, et cetera. And then he certainly representing the unincorporated part of Benton County that's been pretty severely hit. and then multiple philanthropers and some other business representatives of companies that have disaster experience, all of us working collaboratively across the last week of, all right, how do we put this together and what's the right way to execute it?
Who is eligible? Obviously, it's the Benton County Relief Fund, so it's people affected by the storms in Benton County. Any other qualifications?
Yeah, there's a couple to it. Certainly, it's for people in Benton County that were affected by the storm. So you want to make sure the people are in Benton County and affected by the storm. Our goal, one other qualification, first of all, is we're really out to help households that make $125,000 household income or lower. That's pretty much equivalent to our area median income, or AMI, people might be familiar with. But in a simple number, it's really for households that are $125,000 or less. Why that number? I explained the specifics of the number. But, you know, people that are workforce within Northwest Arkansas, you know, may not have as much money setting in a reserve if something like this happens. So you're really trying to make sure you get money to people that may be struggling the most. So that's kind of why that eligibility, if you will. And then, you know, we're trying to avoid redundancies and those types of things. We know money will be coming from other sources, perhaps FEMA or insurance. And so we'll do a simple check on that. But the point is, that money may not be coming for weeks and weeks and weeks, and people are hurting now. So we want to be able to get money out and help people quickly is a big part of this.
And if people are looking, you know, for help or how to get started, they can go to that HARCNWA.com website?
Yeah, there's a lot of different kind of doors into this. You can go to HARCNWA.com, AccelerateFoundation.com. You can go to the Benton County website. You can go to Northwest Arkansas Council website. You know, Bentonville, Decatur, Rogers, all of the different cities. I know the chambers have also been a great partner as far as getting information out as well. So if people look, you're going to be able to find this pretty quickly, I believe. And then from that, it kind of gets funneled our direction, and then we help the people from there.
Our reporter, Matthew Moore, has been up there. I've not set foot in Benton County since the storms, but I've seen the pictures, a lot of devastation. I imagine that there is still opportunity to help with the relief fund, because it looks like there's going to be a lot of need over the next weeks and months.
Yeah, and I mean, people can get money over time from other places, but there's a real need right now, and I think power is just getting fully restored. The other part, you know, I happen to live in Bentonville, and you can go block to block and everything looks fine. You get to the next block and all of a sudden massive devastation that you didn't realize took place. And I know parts of Rogers, Decatur, other of the outlying areas over by War Eagle. I mean, Judge Mooring referenced it looking like Joplin when things were completely flattened. So I know for a lot of people, it may be hard to believe. You mean that just happened in Benton County, but it absolutely has. I know Judge Mooring has toured with the FEMA people, I think two or three different times, and the amount of devastation is why this was declared at a national level by the governor and ultimately the president.
I mentioned earlier that Accelerate administered funds during the COVID-19 pandemic. Was that an aid to getting this going fast, that there was sort of this format in place?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, that whole initiative, we distributed over $16 million to people in Benton County. That was federal COVID relief money. It was a great partnership with Benton County, you know, and a lot of work on there as far as just the qualification process and everything else. So we're kind of halfway good at this, humbly spoken. And, you know, our goal, for example, is to get the money to help the person, but get it in the hands of the provider providing that service. So all of like the emergency rental we did, all those payments went to landlords or the electric company to help people out, et cetera. So our goal is to do that, to make sure the money's getting to the actual provider. So we'll have a goal of doing that as well. And you're always trying to balance this with speed. And so it's not too onerous, if you will. The other part of this is there's also dollars available for nonprofits. So that's a second piece beyond the individual. And when you think of the nonprofits, that can kind of take two different forms. that can be nonprofits that are really scaled up, helping all these individuals that we're talking about, providing those services that are all of a sudden overrun with requests coming to them. So there's funds at the organization level to help the actual organizations scale up and help individuals. But then some of those nonprofits can't even deliver their core services right now because they've been damaged themselves. So there's funds set aside for that purpose as well. Again, we're working through what does that process look like, and we'll have that lined out likely within the week.
Jeff Webster is the president and CEO of Accelerate Foundation. The foundation is administering the Benton County Relief Fund to assist county residents affected by last week's storms and tornadoes. More information about contributing the fund can be found at bentoncountyrelieffund.com. Jeff Webster, thank you for your time.
Yep, thank you. Appreciate it.
It's that age-old tale of love and marriage and money. You're on The Soundbeat. You're listening to the opening overture of Franz Lehár's 1910 operetta, Der Graf von Luxemburg. We are often our own harshest critics. Before its debut, Lehár called the piece sloppy work, completely useless. Despite his opinion, the play ran for 299 straight performances in its original run. The story tells of a bankrupt playboy count approached by a Russian prince with a semi-indecent proposal. He'll pay the count's debts if the count agrees to marry the object of his affection. The marriage would be a sham, but really, what marriage isn't? Sorry, happy anniversary, honey. Anyway, the move would make her royalty, a divorce would make her single, and the prince would make her his wife. How could it possibly go wrong? Find out right now at soundbeat.org. This episode was written in part by Syracuse University student Craig Kober as part of the Soundbeat class partnership. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
The federally funded Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, helped about 23 million unserved and underserved Americans obtain inexpensive or sometimes free internet service. Until recently, funding has expired for the program. Several internet providers are continuing or launching projects to help with digital equity, including Cox Communications, which serves many cities and communities in West and Northwest Arkansas. Tina Gabbard, Market Vice President for Cox Communication, says the ACP aid ended on June 1st.
As a result of that, there are many customers, millions of people actually across the country, and including here in Arkansas, who will no longer be receiving that $30 a month and $10 a month, depending on how they're receiving the benefit subsidy any longer, which will in turn force them to make a decision about their broadband access at their home.
If you have students in your home, if you have someone that needs it for, I don't know, you know, work or health reasons, that can be a very important decision.
That's right. We know that research shows that a third of people that have internet and have been taking advantage of internet or have access to internet at home have actually received their degree, their college degree, online. So without access to that, a third of those people would cease to exist. And there are dozens and dozens of other stats where first-generation college students, as I mentioned, but there are a lot of people who are learning different languages online and have started up businesses online as a result of having access to internet and broadband at home.
If you're in public or elementary or middle or high school, it can be, you know, a study tool or a research tool as well.
That's right. And it's so funny that you mention that, because if you go to any library or McDonald's or Starbucks and you sit outside and see children in their parents' cars with laptops and their Chromebooks from school because they don't have access at home. And so they're trying to get their homework done in their car, or they might be doing it via cell phone. So it's actually pivotal to the success of education for sure.
And then, of course, if you're living in a certain part of rural Arkansas, it's not that easy
or quick to get to a McDonald's or a library where you can get online in your car.
That's right. That's right. And the further you live out, the right. further or the more complicated it is, for sure. And that actually reminds me of something that we are focused on. So even though this program is ceasing to exist effective June 1st, Cox has always been focused on programs that drive and support internet connectivity to underserved and unserved customers. And so for years, for over a decade, we've had a couple of programs called Connect Assist and Connect to Compete. So for those customers and those people who are already on this ACP platform, most of them, if not all, will qualify for both of those programs through Cox.
So how do you do it?
So, and it's so funny that you ask that, because often whenever we talk about this, the first thing we hear is, oh, it's got to be hard, and I don't have time for all of that, and I don't have access to the internet, so how am I going to do it? The red tape actually has been reduced by, and you can see my hands, but nobody else can see my hands, by orders of magnitude, because that's one of the first pieces of feedback that we have always heard, is that it's so hard to get connected and get through all the questions and get through the paper. And so it's a very simple process. Cox.com/ACP for the ACP program, but Cox.com/connect2Compete is that program. So when ACP is gone or is going, these are programs to fall back on, and often they work together. So these are programs that Cox has had for over a decade. They're still here, and they're not going anywhere.
Not everyone who hears this, of course, will be eligible, only because they might not be in a Cox region. Are there other options where people can find affordable, if they're losing ACP, they can find affordable connection to broadband?
Right. There certainly are other companies like Cox that provide services very similar to the ACP program too. And we would absolutely encourage everybody to reach out to that provider as well, that where you live is who is serving you in your home, and that would be the best option.
One of the things that's interesting about trying to get broadband across the state of Arkansas, a small state, a rural state, is that it seems to be bipartisan. Everyone seems to understand the importance of getting broadband in as many houses as possible.
Indeed. So, and not just in Arkansas, but it's true of broadband offices across our entire region at Cox, but I would say even across the United States, because I hear people talking about this in many other markets, but never has there ever been the focus that there has been from a broadband office to truly help us find ways, and you know, competitors too. Just all the providers get very creative and innovative around how they bring broadband to communities that have never previously been served. So that's through unique partnerships and innovations. It's through county judges. It's through constituents. It's through governors and mayors and city and local officials. So they are turning over and looking under every rock and every pebble to get as creative as possible, and partnering with us, as well as just many, many citizens across the United States to make that happen.
Tina Gabbard is Market Vice President for Cox Communications. The federally funded affordable connectivity program ended June 1st. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Most Thursdays, we hear from Leah Uribe, the host of Sound Perimeter. Today, we'll hear from Leah in a slightly different context. She's the guest on the podcast Short Talks from the Hill. Leah speaks with Jennifer Holland about building community partnerships through music. Leah says her academic research has focused on finding Colombian and South American composers.
And it was really hard to find those composers. So I started commissioning some pieces, which is when you connect with the composers and ask them to write for you. And since then, and because of that, I realized that we didn't have those many pieces available for us to play. And I was interested in revealing my identities when I was performing in the world of classical music. We're very much centered about European white dead composers that wrote beautiful music, but it's not the only music that is out there. So since then, I've been very intentional about programming and commissioning and connecting with those composers and bringing their music to different stages, wherever I am, or recordings, conferences, my own curriculum when I teach. So that's basically what I do, connect with composers, get some new pieces, and then make them available for my peers in the world of bassoon or music.
And so how does your research influence your performances then as a musician?
Well, those processes are very interesting because most likely what I play these days is music by composers that are still alive. So that is a very beautiful collaborative process. I reach out to composers or they reach out to me. We work together. We talk about what is possible. Some of them may have experience with the bassoon or not. So we talk about what is technically available in the instrument. Some of them are interested in extended techniques, which is different ways of making sound the bassoon that are not traditional. So we talk about how to make that happen. So it's a very collaborative process. It creates, you know, a special relationship between the composers and me or whoever else is performing with me. So it's very different than just getting a piece from the 1800s or 1500s and trying to make sense of it.
And in 2019, you founded the Reflections Music Series. Tell me a little more about that.
So Reflections was a really beautiful project. It still is around in some sort of shape. And the whole idea is to bring music to the forefront, beautiful music, different music and musicians, but with the intention to have a conversation around it. So our guests have been here either virtually, because some of this project happened during the pandemic, or in person. And what we do is create an environment for them to play for a lot of people, to wow them with their amazing technical and emotional abilities to just move and transform through the power of music, and then talk about what are their choices in terms of repertoire or messages that you want to deliver, or what other ancillary work they do with communities or in their own environments. So it's all to say that music plays a much bigger role than just the concert itself. It has the power to bring people together, to democratize those stages by bringing identities that are not usually centered. Also the ability to reach out to many more people than initially thought of by means of education or public spaces. It has the power to be an advocate for justice and for equality, for many, many other social processes. So that's what we do with Reflections.
And there's a statement on the Reflections website that says, music and the arts are spaces for social innovation. And there's another on there that says, music and the arts rebalance society. Explain what you mean by those.
I think back to my previous comment, you know, when you're in a concert, or the concerts that we put together anyway, we want those spaces to be democratic, to be accessible to all. So there's a tradition, especially with classical music, that you have to cross many doors in order to get to those stages. You have to dress in a certain way. You have to pay a certain amount of money. You have to know the context of the music in order to know when to clap or not to clap, what to enjoy, not to fall asleep, all of those things. But with our concept and our approach, we want this music to be available for all in spaces that are more free, if you will, spaces in which you can just bring yourself as you are, in which you can establish communication with people by you can move around, you can dance, you can clap, you can smile, you don't have to follow those protocols, because it's a place of really connection with the artist. And again, with the conversations we have, that completes the process in which we put the artist at the same level, because we all carry art in our lives. We're all creative creatures. We all want that, have those sensitivities to be able to transform ourselves with our thoughts and our expressions. So that's kind of the whole idea of democratizing and innovating, and also bringing music down to earth, to a life experience, to the moment, and available for all.
I do want to touch, too, on sound perimeter, because Short Talks is not your first podcast. In fact, you're very experienced with podcasts.
Reflections, by the way, has some podcast episodes as well, because that's part of what we do. And that was a result of the pandemic. We didn't have access to audiences, but we had access to KUAF, our local NPR affiliate. So we started talking about these issues for the larger community in Northwest Arkansas, and that was very successful. during the pandemic and afterwards. But because of that also, Sompany Meter was created, which is a short segment that airs during Ozarks at Large on Thursday, but also exists as an NPR podcast by itself. And those are spaces that I thought were important, again, just to expand our musical boundaries. And that's the slogan anyway, which is, let's depart from this idea that the only good composers were the three Bs, as we know in classical music, Brahms, Beethoven, and Bach, and bring some other music and names and instruments and genres. And it's a way just to enjoy music and to provide some context, because again, people are really hesitant sometimes to connect with what we consider classical music because they don't have knowledge. So I provide a little bit of information. If I bring a piece from those, composers, from Brahms, I talk about what it meant at the time, what to listen for. And these are little excerpts. They're not pieces in their totality. And then contrast that with a piece by a Cuban musician with a Latin American rhythms, or somebody playing pipa from China, or maybe some rap and hip hop, because I think, and we think, that those musics can coexist in the same space and bring connections from people, from what they are thinking, where they're from. So it's a very fun thing for me to do. It really is a space for my creativity, but also, like I do in many of my spaces, trying to really bring balance and bring voices and making sure that we all have a space to be and to find ourselves, a window and a mirror to encounter expressions through music.
So if you wanted people to hear the best example or distillation of what a bassoonist does, what would you suggest they listen to?
The bassoon is such a beautiful instrument. Unfortunately, for the longest time, it's been reserved only for the symphony orchestra. So even if you go to the symphony orchestra, the bassoon is so far removed from the front that you only see the little bell over there. But I think that with time, especially since the 20th century, and especially these days, there's a great interest to promote the instruments to cross boundaries of genres. So searching YouTube for bassoon and jazz would be really productive. Jazz and bossa nova, Brazilian, Latin American bassoon. You'll find a lot of new expressions. And of course, there's the most important concerto we play, is the Mozart Bassoon Concerto. Still, it's a very dear piece to our hearts. It is also asked that we play it in every audition and to join an orchestra or to join a new job or anything in music. But, Baroque music was really a good place for the instrument. Vivaldi wrote like 40 pieces for bassoon. So there's a lot to explore right there. Of course, you can follow me on my social media, and I have lots of examples of pieces that I have commissioned by composers that I just admire very much. Mario Lavista, Noelia Scalzo, Carolina Noguera. Just a few examples of people that I am working with at the moment. I'm getting ready to bring their music to conferences, and just amazing music, beautiful music for bassoon.
So before we end, I just want to note that our intro and outro today are snippets from one of your own recordings. Can you tell us a little more about what we're listening to?
The movement is called Ojo de Tormenta, from the piece Sweet Argentina para Jugar con Andrea by Argentinian composer Jorge Mockert. It is a really fun piece that explores different dances from Argentina, which we in Latin America connect music and indigenous music. In this recording, I am accompanied by Miroslava Panayotova piano and Fernando Valencia percussion, and this is part of a recording project that we did at the music department a few years ago at Haxton Road Studios in Bentonville.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to include those, and thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, and everybody, and please listen to and follow Sound Perimeter.
Tomorrow in Ozarks at Large, 75 years of the Northwest Arkansas Hand Weavers Guild.
My first interest was sparked when I was at the Smithsonian in Washington, and I saw a loom, an old loom, being used. And I fell in love with the loom more than what was being woven.
We'll learn more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors to today's show included Daniel Carruth, Jack Travis, Paul Gatling, Roby Brock, Jennifer Holland, and Leah Uribe. KUAF's technical director is Y.K. Karenbauer.
Matthew produced today's show inside the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 2.
Kyle, this evening at the Fayetteville Public Library, you are moderating a conversation, Q&A, with
Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Yes.
Yes. So, basically, she's going to sit down in front of people and answer questions I ask her.
You've read some of her books.
Several, yes.
I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this. You were probably not the target audience for her books, I would assume.
I would assume that's the case too, but they're wildly entertaining and really good. So, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, and I can always appreciate when someone who is not a target audience can appreciate a book.
You know, I think that's more the publishing industry. They say, let's give this to this audience because that's who is more likely to buy it. But they underestimate all of us, right?
We're multifaceted
in our interests.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, that's tonight.
Tonight at 7 at the Fayetteville Public Library.
The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society's 26th season of the Summer Jazz Concert Series presents the Ted Ludwig Quartet, featuring Pat Bianchi, Paul Carr, and Stephen Pruitt, Saturday, June 15th at 7:30 p.m. at Walton Arts Center. Tickets and information available at digjazz.com/events.